Want a Vegemite sandwich for dinner tonight? I don't think so. This portion of the program brought to you by Theater Kalamazoo, home to more than a dozen producing theaters in Southwest Michigan. Visit theaterkalamazoo.com for a full listing of theaters and upcoming shows. 64 in Kalamazoo now, the temperature starting to drop already. Down in the lower 40s tonight, upper 30s potentially out in the more rural areas. And we're going to be here in the next few minutes talking to Jill Fritz. She is the Michigan State Director of the Humane Society of the United States. And wolf killing licenses go on sale this week. And one of the questions I have for her is, what impact does killing a individual wolf have to the wolf pack that that wolf belongs to? Wolf packs are like a family, and we all know a death in the family changes things. Somebody has to step up, their roles have to change, and a family has to adapt with the abrupt departure of one of the family members. Well, we're going to talk about what happens in a wolf family. If you think of a wolf pack as sort of a family in that they function together with the leadership, the alpha male and the alpha female. And on many levels, there's an analogy to a human family. And we'll talk to Jill about just what we know about the impact of culling a wolf pack. If we at random take out a member of the pack. Nature doesn't usually work that way. Nature takes the weakest. A wolf prey tends to be the sick or the young, the injured, and but hunters aren't selective in who they remove from the herd, and so that's why we bring in guests like Jill Fritz to talk to us about this. Hi, Jill. How you doing?
Okay. How are you?
Fat and sassy on this end. let me mention that you're the state director for the Humane Society of the United States. And your organization is one of a number of organizations working to keep wolves protected in Michigan. And I don't think you we were connected early enough to hear one of the questions I wanted to ask you today. Mm-hmm. And that is, if you think of a wolf pack as analogous to a human family, what impact does taking out a wolf out of that family have? We know in human families, roles have to change. The family has to adapt to the abrupt departure of a family member. What happens in a wolf pack when hunters just randomly remove somebody from the pack?
Well, wolves' packs are very close-knit. As you said, they have a pair, the alpha pair of the pack, that do the breeding for the most part and the teaching of the members of the pack in how to hunt and how to survive. And if there's a situation where a hunter or a trapper takes out one of the alpha pair, then that could disrupt the pack and could in fact make things worse as far as there's any livestock depredation by the members of the pack, because the teachers, the elders of the pack who would have taught the other pack members how to hunt effectively might be gone, and so they could disperse, and it could bring in wolves from other areas who are not as good at hunting and may be more prone to attacking livestock.
Okay. So that is a concern. I didn't invent something here. Just randomly killing a wolf could have a huge impact on the pack that that wolf is a part of.
Absolutely. And it really underscores how there has been no scientific evidence presented to support the need for a wolf hunt in the Upper Peninsula. And the fact that if their existing law already allows problem wolves that might attack livestock or dogs to be taken out individually on a case-by-case basis. But just having a random wolf hunt and killing random wolves will not do anything to address the problem and could, in fact, make it worse.
How many wolves will there be permits to kill issued this year?
There are 43 wolves will be allowed to be taken out in this first season, divided into three what are called wolf management units in the UP, 16 in one unit, 19 in another, and 8 in the third unit.
43 seems to be a pretty specific number. How was that number arrived at? How did they calculate from the number of depredations to the number of wolves that 43 was the magic number that needed to be killed this year?
Those were numbers proposed by the DNR in its proposal to the Natural Resources Commission to have a hunt in the three different management units. And for each of the units, it gave a reason for why they wanted to take out that certain amount of wolves. In Unit A, which is in western Gogebic County, they claimed that it was because of concerns about human-wolf interaction. In Unit B, which covers Ontonagon, Houghton, and Baraga counties, they claimed it was because of livestock depredations or attacks by wolves on livestock. Mm-hmm. And in Unit C, which is in Luce and Mackinac counties, they claimed that it was conflicts between wolves and dogs. So, but what we found, as we've mentioned on your show before, is that in that wildlife wolf management unit B in Ontonagon, Baraga, and Houghton counties, the vast majority of the reported wolf attacks on livestock occurred on one farm mm-hmm. that had a pretty egregious record of animal care. And leaving carcasses strewn around the property for all predators to come and get, and also not even taking care of his own cattle.
We're talking with Jill Fritz, Michigan State Director of the Humane Society of the United States. Jill, in the western, the most region in the UP, where human interaction was cited as the reason to need to kill wolves, fill us in on what kind of human interaction was documented that led to the numbers the DNR chose to kill there.
Well, it was about a year ago. There were reports of a pack of wolves that had become habituated to the area around the city of Ironwood. And there was one incident where a deer had been killed and wolves were feeding on the deer within the city limits. And people became concerned. The wolves were not threatening or harming anyone, but people became concerned and called the DNR to take care of it. And so shooters were brought out and did kill the entire pack of 8 wolves. So they used existing law, and the problem was addressed. So that incident was cited as a reason why they wanted to have a random hunt, though, in that area, which would not do any good. It would just result in killing random wolves in the area. So it was a good example of how there's already a law in place that allows problem wolves to be taken out, and those need to be addressed individually and specifically. Mm-hmm. And just opening up a season on wolves would not do anything to address the problem.
How will you mentioned the three districts, were the 43 divided up evenly amongst those three wolf districts? And
no.
Okay. They were allocated based on supposed need in each of those regions. How many wolves would lead to a safer situation if they were removed?
That was the claim, yes. In that first unit, 16 wolves in Gavita County, 19 in Wildlife Wolf Management Unit B, and 8 in C in the Mackinac, Lewis County area.
How will they make sure that, how many killing permits are going to be used, issued?
Well, yes. Yeah, they will, beginning this coming Saturday, September 28th, the DNR will begin selling 1,200 licenses to kill the 43 wolves. Beginning November 15th.
How do they make sure that not every one of those licenses that are issued kills a wolf? If we get to that number 43, did the other people who gave their money to the state just lose?
Well, the DNR has said that when they reach that quota in each of those three units, then that unit will be closed and they will no longer be able to hunt four wolves in those units, in each of those three units.
So that's how
the DNR set it up.
But the licenses are not specific to a unit. And so if you have a license to kill a wolf, if they shut down the easternmost region, you could still go to the western region and try to find a wolf to shoot.
I guess you'd have to talk to the DNR about how you'd go about doing that.
Specific to each unit?
Oh, no, I do not know. Honestly, you'd have to ask the DNR how that would be managed. But
okay.
All I know is the licenses will be going on sale this coming Saturday, and they will sell 1,200 licenses to kill the 43 wolves.
How big of a money maker is this for the state? Do you know what the costs are for a license?
It is $100 for an in-state resident for a wolf tag and $500 for an out-of-state resident.
Okay. Changing the subject before we have to go our separate ways, can you give us an update on the progress in collecting signatures to protect wolves and to leave the citizens of the state involved in how we handle these things?
It's going extremely well. We have volunteers all over the state, from Houghton to Sault Ste. Marie to Traverse City, Grand Rapids, Detroit, everywhere in between. And citizens are incredibly enthusiastic. They're just grabbing the pens out of our hands to be able to sign the petition. So they're even telling us the talking points of the campaign. They're informing our signature collectors about how this whole thing is a debacle and based on misinformation and fear and anti-wolf hysteria. And they're horrified, too, that there's this small, vocal, extreme minority who wants to kill wolves so bad that they've goaded the legislature into passing a bill specifically to circumvent a referendum. I mean, as if our legislature has nothing better to do with its time.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd think they could find something more positive to be involved in.
Yes, but it's going extremely well.
Well, good. I appreciate your taking time to chat with us this afternoon, Jill.
Thank you.
Have a good afternoon.
You too. Thank you.
And Jill Fritz, the director for Michigan State for the Humane Society of the United States. 65 degrees. I'll give you the full AccuWeather forecast coming right up. /427, 65 degrees. Mostly sunny this afternoon. Would you quit messing with things, Binder? I lost my headphones. A high 66. I think we've passed that. Mostly clear and chilly tonight, 42 the low. And mostly sunny tomorrow and Wednesday, 68 and 74 respectively. And are you finally sitting down?
My headphones don't work. I don't know what's wrong with them.
Oh, well, you had mine not working, too. So don't mess with things. Leave them alone now. Hey, we have established that the Tigers, I have a minion who helps me with that algorithm you've tried to teach me on how to calculate games.
I wish I could talk to him because I'd rather talk to your minion, but due to the lack of my headphones not working, I apologize, but thank you, Michael, through the glass.
So, the Tigers cannot take their league today. Even if they win, they'll still be needing one more game, either
right.
a loss by the – no, two losses by the Indians, right?
Right, from here on for the next couple of days, here's what the landscape looks like. The Tigers either need to win two games consecutively, so it can't just happen with one win tonight. Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah.
Okay.
They can't clinch it tonight.
It would take a win and a Cleveland loss, but
they're not playing
right.
tonight.
So,
Cleveland isn't.
Right. Cleveland's not. Detroit's in Minnesota opening a series. So it's going to take two consecutive wins, basically. So tonight and tomorrow. So if they win tonight, they could potentially clinch tomorrow with a win.
Okay. What do you think the odds of them taking two games in a row from the Twins?
Possible. Definitely possible. There are a lot of question marks, though.
Yeah, I could run a 4-minute mile. That might be possible, but it's not likely to happen.
It's highly likely, I would say.
Okay, out of a three-game series. Okay.
However, if by some chance they just implode and blow the Twins series, I would say it's highly, even more likely that they're going to sweep the Marlins because the Marlins are not good.
Okay.
Bottom feeders.
Is it safe to assume that the Tigers would be capable of a complete meltdown and not winning two of the three games?
You know, the question marks that have existed with Justin Verlander this entire season, and I hate to say that because he's, of course, the team's ace, but he could go completely off the deep end from what we've seen. There's, you know, Miguel Cabrera. Are they going to sit him? Is he going to be healthy? Jose Iglesias, what's going on with him and his hand and his health? Johnny Peralta is going to get in the mix here eventually, and then possibly in the next couple of. I think he's available actually off of his suspension for the Miami series, but who knows what's going to happen if and when they throw him into the mix? So there's a lot of fun stuff going on for the last couple of series here for the Detroit Tigers.
So are you suggesting listenership will be up in the next few games? Because if you're a
yes.
fan, you're
this
sitting
is,
on the edge of your seat.
This is your wheelhouse. Even if you're not a fan, if you're a casual fan of the Detroit Tigers, you're definitely tuning in.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right.
We call her Dr. Sports. You call her Carolyn Binder. Raj Taylor taking you home this afternoon. This portion of the program brought to you by Bronson. Their comprehensive breast center is here for you every step of the way. Call them at 341-8700 to schedule your mammogram. Learn more at bronsonhealth.com/women. CBS News at the top of the hour mentioned that Archer Daniels Midland was going to pull their headquarters out of Decatur, Illinois. I was curious where they were moving their headquarters to, and apparently Chicago is on the short list. For the same reason Boeing moved their headquarters to Chicago as well. You can get to anywhere in the world from Chicago, and O'Hare seems to operate on a schedule which is not something the New York City airports do so well. Joining me now is Dr. Philip Kaper, and I came across him in a op-ed he wrote in the Bangor Daily News. And being a neighbor of Canada, he shares some of the same perspective that we do. Good afternoon, Dr. Kaper.
How are you, Roger?
I'm good, thanks. Well, let's start with your op-ed suggests Maine has been grappling with the same issue that Michigan has been, although Michigan did decide to expand Medicaid, but to delay it 3 months for no apparent reason, instead of the program taking effect in January, people will have to remain uninsured three more months. In the discussion that's taken place in Maine, give us a picture of the mindset opposed to Medicaid expansion.
Well, I think it's safe to say that it's pretty totally ideologic. These are people who just think that the government should not have any role in health care, and they look upon Medicaid as welfare, which is what they call it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I can't think of any other reason, because it means that they turned down several hundred million federal dollars coming into the state, even though people here in Maine are paying taxes that contribute to other states receiving that money and that help instead of us. Plus the fact that they are keeping about 69,000, 70,000 people here from having access to medical care in the way they should. So I don't understand it in terms other than the purely political ideology.
Well, in Michigan, we're talking about numbers of people approaching a half million. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars being lost just in that three-month delay that our senators threw in at the last minute by not making it immediately effective.
Right.
It waits 90 days from the end of the session under this approach, which means the first quarter of the year, Michiganders will not be involved in the Affordable Care Act.
Have
you gotten any inclination what rates are going to be in Maine? The Affordable Care Act goes into effect even if you don't extend Medicaid to uninsured people.
Yeah, that's correct. And we've had some preliminary guesses at it, but that information really isn't out for the public yet. It'll be coming out very soon, and they're going to try to start enrolling the people who choose to join the exchanges in them starting October 1st.
Mm-hmm.
But as you probably gleaned from my article about Canada, I actually write a monthly column for the Bangor Daily News, and I pick a healthcare topic every month and talk about it in the column. I think one of the problems with our healthcare system is that the way we pay for it is based on insurance, and the fundamental business of insurance is slicing and dicing people into smaller and smaller risk pools. Well, insurance is a business of assessing risk and managing risk and eliminating risk when possible.
Mm-hmm.
And in healthcare, they tend to do that by trying to steer away from the sickest people. The commercial insurance companies don't like to sell insurance to people who are likely to become ill,
mm-hmm.
because that cuts into their profits. And I don't blame them for that. I blame the business model that they're engaged in. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, and that is creating wealth for their owners, their shareholders, and their and their executives, and they're doing a very good job of that. But unfortunately, in so doing, they actually impair the delivery of health care, whereas a program like Medicare, which, as you know, is the federal program for the seniors, that's a program whose basic mission is to facilitate the delivery of medical care. So you have two very different models here.
Mm-hmm.
One impairing the delivery of medical care and the other facilitating it. And as I say, I don't blame the insurance companies for doing what they're doing. That's who they are. And everybody knows that. I blame us, the public, for letting them do it. I think it's not a fault of theirs. It's a failure of public policy in this country. And you know, I'm an advocate for a single nonprofit healthcare system for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had that, we wouldn't be arguing about who to kick out.
Right.
Because everybody would be in it.
Right.
So we wouldn't be pitting the young people against the older people and the poor people against the wealthy people and so on and so forth. And that's what I'd like to see happen. That's what every other wealthy country in the world has. And in every other wealthy country in the world, they cover everybody in their healthcare system. The results they get are better than ours. That's an indisputable fact. The outcomes, the infant mortality rate and general health of the population and so on. Their systems are far more popular than ours with both their public and their politicians because everybody has a stake in it, same system. And by the way, it costs about half of what ours does.
Yeah.
So what's not to like about that? I'm puzzled.
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
Dr. Philip, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that ideology comes to play.
Yeah.
Is that ideology whether or not humans have a right to health care?
Yeah.
Doesn't that get to the bottom line here, is that conservatives think only people who've got money should have health care and that it is not a basic human right?
Right, yeah. We're the only industrialized country that has not made health care a human right. The United States is the only country that has done that. And I think there is a feeling on the right that people need to earn what they get. They shouldn't be given to them.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, we're not willing. Somebody gets run down by a train or a truck or falls off a ladder, we're not willing to just let them lay there unless they have insurance. They get taken care of one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But it's done in the most expensive and ineffective way possible. They get emergency care, and then they're thrown back out into on their own resources. And many people don't have the resources to do the appropriate follow-up or the appropriate preventive care.
Mm-hmm.
So I say it's primarily ideology because it makes no sense from an economic perspective. It's actually cheaper to cover everybody than it is to figure out who to exclude and spend a lot of money arguing about who pays for what. And it's certainly not defensible, to my way of thinking, on moral grounds.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really immoral to deny people health care because they don't happen to be a well-compensated executive or a member of a union with good benefits or whatever. Because I'm speaking as a physician. I don't want to have to do a wallet biopsy, which is what we call it, on the patient sitting in front of me before I decide what kind of treatment they should have.
Yeah, you talk about a death panel. Wallet biopsy, that's an interesting expression. We're talking with Dr. Philip Caper, a practicing physician in Maine, and I came across him in an op-ed in the Bangor Daily News. How are businesses going to compete on a world basis in the future if we don't rein in our medical expense? We're seeing big companies, Walgreens just recently threw up their hands and said they can't afford to insure their employees anymore, and so they're going to give them some cash and set them loose in the marketplaces that are being set up. When other countries that we compete with economically have half the expense that we do for health care, how are even the private companies who can afford to offer insurance now be assured they're going to be able to insure their employees in the future?
Well, they can't, Roger. I mean, one of the reasons they're doing that's been going on for years, is the companies have gradually been shifting more and more of the costs onto their employees. And if they're in a unionized situation and the unions demand retaining the current health care benefits, what happens is the employees' wages go down. It's taken out of their wages. So my friends in the unions tell me that they no longer bargain for wages or working conditions. All they're doing is trying to keep their health care benefits. And every year they're costing more and more. So it's had an effect of depressing wages. And it also has had an effect of creating job lock, because a lot of people retain their jobs simply to keep the health coverage.
Right.
Small businesses don't offer health coverage normally, or very good health coverage. And that, to me, is a drag on the economy, because it discourages entrepreneurship. It discourages people going out and starting their own companies because they are afraid of losing their health care benefits. And I mentioned in my column at the very end that the Canadians are now wealthier than Americans. That's true. The average Canadian is now wealthier than the average American. And one of the reasons for that is because they have a single health care system that's government-funded through taxes, and they've been able to keep the costs down far below what our costs are.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're in Michigan. Ask the auto companies that have factories in Canada as well as factories in the U.S., and they'll tell you that they're much better off. Cost of production are lower in Canada because they don't have to cover health.
Absolutely. The United States lost a Toyota transmission plant to Ontario simply because they didn't have to pay for health care for employees if they opened their plant in Ontario.
So why do you think it's so hard to persuade Americans that they ought to emulate the Canadians and just, instead of paying for health care through insurance, which actually only happened as an accident during the Second World War, it was a side product, a byproduct of wage and price controls.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it's so hard to convince them that the Canadian way is a better way to go?
Right.
I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about the Canadian system.
Oh, there's a lot of misinformation out there about the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, yeah.
It isn't just misrepresenting other countries' health plans. There are groups misrepresenting the Affordable Care Act on an active daily basis.
It's very easy to do because it's so very complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, my latest column that was out last Friday, it talks about the complexity of health care reform and how costly that is. Both in terms of dollars, I mean, it costs a lot of money to run something that complicated, with all the different categories of insurance and the computer systems that are necessary and all that stuff. We would have been much better off just expanding our Medicare program to cover everyone and tacking it onto a payroll tax or a value-added tax or some other kind of tax. Much more efficient and much easier to understand.
Well, you know, when you look at the polling that says the Affordable Care Act isn't popular, one of the misleading pieces of information is you and I would be included in that because we don't think the Affordable Care Act goes far enough.
Right.
I wanted to see a single-payer system like you're referring to.
Right,
So you and I are lumped into the critics of the Affordable Care Act, along with the people who don't think health care is a human right.
Right. The figures I've seen are about 20% of the people who don't like the Affordable Care Act want us to go further. They want to go to a single payer. And one of the costs I talk about in my most recent column is that there's a high price being paid in terms of public confusion about the Affordable Care Act. And it's very easy to demonize because it's so complicated and people... You know, you have to fill out a 20-page application to determine which part of it you are eligible for.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that categorization complexity of it adds enormous cost. We think about $400 billion a year in the U.S. In unnecessary administrative costs attributable strictly to the complexity of that law.
I urge people to look up the Bangor Daily News and add the name Philip Caper to that search, and you'll find his interesting columns. I appreciate your joining us this afternoon, Dr. Caper.
Well, very nice chatting with you, Roger. Good luck with your show.
Have a good day.
You too. Thank you.
Dr. Philip Caper, and with a perspective that is similar to ours because of Maine's proximity to a healthcare system that we perhaps should have been emulating. Quick traffic note for you. Eastbound I-94, left lane closed at mile marker 19. Police and fire on the scene.
This is Kalamazoo's news station and Kalamazoo's home for Detroit Tiger baseball. 590 WKZO Kalamazoo.